Hello and welcome to the Access Point podcast series from Quintiles IMS. My name is John Doyle. I am the global team leader for our enterprise solutions team in Real World Insights. In this series, we'll take an in-depth look at the latest issue of Access Point, our annual publication on current trends, insights, and advancements in real world evidence. In this issue, we'll focus on innovation, the methodologies, technologies that are pushing the boundaries of how evidence is being generated and used across the healthcare system. Today, I'm pleased to be joined by Nelia Padilla and Michael Finney to discuss the application of wearables in clinical trials. Thank you both very much for joining me today.
Thanks for having us, John.
Yes, glad to be here.
Well, wearables just seem to be ubiquitous, right? They're everywhere. Now, from the Fitbit that we're wearing when we work out to the glucose monitors that we hear about in research. And I'd like to hear from your two perspectives, you know, what's going on in the clinical trial space? You know, is this incremental improvement in efficiency of gathering data, or are we looking at a step change in terms of measuring patient outcomes?
It's an interesting question, John. We get that all the time because this is an example of technologies that started in the consumer space and are now starting to move into more of a regulated clinical trial area. And from what we've seen, what's really exciting here is it's really the start of something very different in how clinical trials are approached. From my perspective, I think it's one of the interesting things is that it's bringing the patient's voice much more to the forefront in clinical trials by using these wearables than in the past. It's a way of being able to measure what actually happens to the patient, what matters to the patient on a day-to-day basis when experiencing their disease or their condition. And what's also really interesting about the use of wearables in clinical trials, that's just the beginning of something a little bit more than incremental, is the objectivity that they bring to the collection of information. Now, one example that has been cited a lot with respect to wearables versus the way trial data was collected in the past are ER diaries, patient diaries. There's so many times when patients were asked to, in longhand, fill out paper forms and document some of their symptoms and then submit to the physicians for documentation in clinical trials. I don't know about you, but many of us are human, including myself. And so whenever I'm given homework, sometimes I don't do it right at the time and fill in the paperwork right before it's due. And that's what happened to a lot of these journals. It was patients filling them in at the last minute in the doctor's offices, not at the time that the symptoms were actually being noticed. And that's the objective nature that wearables actually brings to the table. We're actually now able to capture some of the information real time when things happen, as opposed to relying on recollection at a much later point in time.
Yeah, you bring up a couple of really good points I want to emphasize. You know, one is B101, you learn about the trials and tribulations of recall bias and just how that could really become a problem when trying to assess patient history when relying on diaries, so to speak. And you also emphasize consumer perspective and the patient's voice. How can pharma companies engage with patients when designing trials that are going to use wearables to ensure that they truly are reflecting the patient point of view?
That's actually something that's extremely important. There's so many ways of engaging with patients, and whether it be reaching out to patient advocacy group, reaching out to patients individually, but also I would encourage pharma companies to start thinking about patients as consumers, especially when we think about digital technologies and not just as patients. So why do I mention that? So if you can imagine, a wearable is something that in a trial setting, we want consumers to use all the time in order to gather the best information possible. But a consumer isn't going to wear their wearable or use it unless it fits into their everyday life. And that goes beyond just their disease or their condition. So when pharma companies are developing the trials, they should definitely try to understand what's the consumer's lifestyle, what is the way in which the wearable fits in? Are they going to be swimming? Are they going to be very active? Are they going to be very sedentary? Is it easy to put on? Is it easy to adjust? A lot of things that may not be as intuitive based on the way past trials were designed for drugs and not including the wearables.
It's interesting the way you phrase it. It's almost like using wearables provides a channel for the pharma companies to better reflect real-world use of their product because it essentially forces them to think through how the patient will behave in the real world. You know, you also mentioned something important about objective measurement and how this is a step in the right direction of ensuring objective measurement, validity and reliability and such. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the detractors out there and what they think about the use of wearables in clinical trials?
Just like anything else, there's definitely conflicting thoughts about the benefit of wearables. And I would say a lot of it has to do with a very natural learning curve in using wearables in a new way. It's not just monitoring heart rate to see if you're exercising on a personal level or following your personal trends, but rather using it to make different types of decisions that are more associated with what are traditionally clinical outcomes. So the detractors are really saying, well, these aren't quite, for a lot of the wearables out there today, they may not be quite fit for purpose or have the right type of accuracy or sensitivity or specificity. Where some of the detractors might also be saying, we may not necessarily need them because we have so many medical devices that are already available for monitoring blood pressure and heart rate. Whereas the proponents are actually thinking of it more from the perspective, as you said, John, how can all of this be incorporated into the real world? Very few of us medically required carry around blood pressure monitoring cuffs with us all the time, whereas it's very easy and very different to have either a different wearable to check heart rates, for example. And so it's more the difference of how do you incorporate it into your everyday life and use that information into something that's meaningful and that we can get different endpoints out of, as opposed to trying to force fit the traditional endpoints into what the wearables can provide.
Just to add on that, with the aspect of objective measurement, definitely see that as an opportunity area for wearables. So, for example, we saw a past sponsor, they were developing a new urology treatment to help patients with sleep interruptions. In addition to using patient journals, as Nelia mentioned in a previous conversation here, sponsor treated the patients in hospitals just to enable video recording of the night activity. Unfortunately, there were very significant discrepancies between the video recordings and the data entered into these patient journals. To address these discrepancies, the sponsor tried an actigraph, a wearable, with advanced software to enable annotations of the reasons for why patients got up in the middle of the night. As a result of using this wearable, the sponsor was able to collect robust patient data, providing explanations for the sleep interruptions. So ultimately, by using this wearable, the sponsor was able to address past difficulties in proving the efficacy of the treatment, which should now position them well to obtain intended product label.
Thank you both for that. I mean, it seems listening to both of you that it's really not looking at these wearable devices as inputs that should be isolated or siloed. It has to be thought about in a very integrated way, and maybe even more importantly, be thoughtful about the interaction between what's happening based on the wearable data and what's happening to other variables being collected. So it's a very holistic view of the patient that we're trying to achieve. There's another aspect of your article that I found particularly compelling, which is pushing industry further to adopt almost a technology-oriented approach to succeeding fast and failing fast and proof of concept work. I'd love to hear a little bit more about your thoughts on that.
Absolutely. You know, many folks are, including myself, are big proponents of not reinventing the wheel. And this is one where technology companies and other industries have already demonstrated a really robust way of testing digital technologies, of making sure that things are appropriate for the type of use, developing use cases, understanding ideas of minimum viable product, and And so taking all of these learnings, all of these success factors from other industries and bringing it back to the healthcare industry and thinking about how we can adapt it. And one of the biggest things that we see that pharma companies and other healthcare stakeholders can do is really learn about moving quickly, being willing to fail, but being willing to fail in a smart way. Instead of going for very large pilots or traditional trials like we're used to seeing from most pharmaceutical medical device companies, it's breaking down a lot of the components and thinking about small proof of concept. So, for example, how do you make sure that as a company, you know what the best wearable is to measure the right information? Well, a lot of times the shiny and new objects can be very attractive, but they may not necessarily be the best ones for your particular needs. So how do you test a variety of them very, very quickly without having to do very large trials or get involved in very cumbersome testing requirements? So breaking it down into proof of concepts to either test the technology, test the feasibility of measuring new endpoints and collecting new types of information. A lot of times things sound great. So for example, if I were to say, I really want to capture how many times a person is smiling as a little bit of a silly example, but not too far, the feasibility of it might actually not be as easy as just a well-documented mood rating. So learning how to do what's feasible, learning how to select the right technologies, and doing all of these in small proof of concept ways that when you add up all the proof of concepts, you've done them very quickly and you have a much more robust starting point for a larger program that would entail a lot more dollars, risk, and time.
And just to reiterate the value of these proof of concepts that Nellie nicely articulated, even if the technology is well understood, new risks may arise that need to be mitigated before the trial starts. Just as a recent example, there was a small biotech company that conducted a clinical trial using a wearable to capture patient data. The sponsor used sites across the country, with many being located on the West Coast. The data, though, of the wearable was not uploaded at the sites. Rather, the devices were shipped back to the sponsor for data uploading. Unfortunately, the wearables did not have an internal clock, so the times were off by up to 3 hours in some instances. So ultimately, a proof of concept here could have uncovered that challenge with the technology, which would have definitely saved a lot of time and resources spent on having to clean the data afterwards.
Thank you both for sharing those insights. It seems like you're really pushing the operating model for trial design to adopt some of the best practices, if you will, from technology companies. And thinking a little bit more about, Nellie, what you had said before about the consumer space just leads me to another best practice, if you will, from technology companies, which is really simulating the patient/consumer experience. I mean, that's essentially what design thinking is all about. And in looking at this wearable space and reading through your article, it seems like we're heading in that direction. Pharma companies using wearables to essentially create or simulate the user experience. How would you comment on that?
So one of the important things here, John, that you bring up is that consumer experience, the everyday life. And that's one of the really interesting differences between what a wearable can offer versus what a medical device can offer. As I mentioned earlier, if you have a need for continuous heart rate monitoring, for example, it's very difficult up until relatively recently to have a large device on you, actually, a medical device for continuous heart rate monitoring with a big battery pack. And it was actually quite cumbersome to carry these around in order to make sure you weren't having any cardiac symptoms indicative of something larger. Nowadays, with wearables, the technology is progressing at such a pace where it's becoming less and less intrusive and it's more possible to incorporate it into your everyday life. There is still a little bit of a difference between medical devices versus consumer wearables, but there's starting to be a very big convergence. And what's really exciting about all of this is that the pharma companies can now really take that consumer experience on an everyday basis and potentially find novel and new ways of raising what's important to patients, to both regulators, payers, and other stakeholders that we don't always talk about in the consumer space. So things that would be important for a patient associated with their quality of life, for example, could become much more relevant when measuring it with wearables than measuring with some of the traditional medical devices.
So let's get pragmatic. If I'm running a clinical development program or a real-world evidence development program, and I want to include wearables for all the reasons that you and Michael have outlined, you know, where do I start? How do I triage my different trials to determine which ones are best suited for wearables, if that's possible? And then once I do, what's the first step in getting started?
So I would actually say, John, that the very first step is making sure there is a clear understanding of why you would need to measure something different and what it is that you would want to measure. So even before you start identifying any of the specific trials, it's identifying either a specific drug or disease or therapeutic area and saying, we need to be differentiated for X, Y, and Z reasons, for competitive advantages or for reimbursement advantages. And once you've identified which specific disease and or drug you want to tackle, then I would say it's really starting to embrace some of the things that we mentioned in the article. So having a very clear mentality around the proof of concept. So if you want to test and differentiate your product, well, what are the endpoints and what are the things you need to measure that are going to really make a difference? And start there. What is the need? Then it's more about, all right, well, not just going after the bright and shiny object, but making sure that you have a proof of concept for identifying the most appropriate way of collecting the information that's going to help you collect your endpoint or demonstrate whatever it is that you need to prove. From there, you can go down a path of a lot of operational types of questions and logistical types of questions, both for the technologies and the endpoints. But just as importantly, it's also thinking about how you as an organization are structured to do this for the trial. Many times, our clients or companies are set up to do very large trials and not proof of concepts. So even questions like who would be funding a proof of concept? Who would own the proof of concept? Who's going to run the proof of concept can be difficult questions if an organization is not set up for it. And it's something that is very important in order to make sure that they can be run quickly, the learnings can be applied very quickly, and the process doesn't get bogged down in bureaucracy. The other thing I would say, you know, getting very tactical, is it's important to know where you're going, but also thinking about what the end point is going to be. Once a company has all of the data collected from a wearable, what are they going to do with it? It's extremely important in the planning, knowing what the how that data is going to be used at the end. So, for example, if we go back to the Fitbit example, let's assume a company wants to only measure and only collect the data on the number of steps from the Fitbit. The Fitbit also happens to collect a lot of other information. Some of them collect GPS location, some of them collect heart rates, some of them collect max saturation oxygen levels, etc. And there's no way to turn off all of that information, and the company's going to be receiving it. So what do they do with it? How do they handle it in addition to the step information that they actually want? So making sure that there's a good data strategy from the very beginning is going to be important. And then, as you mentioned earlier on, John, it's extremely important to communicate with healthcare providers that are going to be involved with the products, as well as patients and consumers, to make sure that it fits into their either practice and or their everyday life. Otherwise, it's just not going to be used in the most effective way, and the data that is collected is not going to be as high quality as one would expect. And finally, again, with starting with the end in mind, making sure that there are key performance indicators and learning goals that are specific to the different stakeholders. So what is it that's going to be important to measure success from a physician perspective, a consumer perspective, a trial sponsor perspective, et cetera? Those are also going to be extremely important and learning from the technology sector in order to move very quickly from failure and learning from mistakes.
And I like how Nelly had pointed out those two key points. You know, John, not having a clear strategy. We see sponsors, they get distracted with the new shiny technology and really lose focus on their goals. And number two, having those clear endpoints really ties in nicely. So building upon that example with the Fitbit that Nelly had mentioned, we actually saw a past sponsor. They tried to tie in Fitbit into their trial to explore a potential respiratory indication. Fortunately, they didn't have that strategy up front. They didn't have the clear clinical endpoints. And as a result, the trial experienced inconsistent frequency and quality of data being collected. This then led to multiple protocol amendments, which really increased the administrative burden. In the end, the trial could no longer be justified from a financial perspective and was ultimately canceled. So just to serve as a case study to visualize and put into the real world, Melia's key points about these challenges and what's needed for to have a successful proof of concept and successful incorporation of wearable in a clinical trial, this example was really powerful.
Yeah, agreed, Michael. I mean, I just listening to both of your commentary, it just makes me think that's best practice, really, regardless of digital or non-digital channels, what you've outlined. And I'm wondering if the wearables just represent a catalyst and a new channel to do it the right way, essentially planning with the end in mind, as you both outline. So thank you for that. What I'd like to ask now is more about your perspectives on the future. So when you look at a new technology such as this, it's always fun to think about this trajectory. Is it going to be exponential adoption? Is it linear? Is it going to plateau? Does it look like a sine curve in a few years? So maybe you both can comment on the outlook.
Why don't I go ahead and start, and then I can hand it over to Michael. Right now, I would say we're on the precipice of not just wearables, but digital health in general. What's really exciting is Rock Health follows quite a few companies in the U.S., and just in the first half of 2017, there were more digital health deals and dollars invested than ever before in a half year, and I think they've been tracking them, I would say, for about at least 4 to 6 years. Yeah, there were over 188 digital health deals in the U.S. in the first 6 months of 2017, which is huge. And this is all despite a little bit of uncertainty with respect to the direction that regulators, notably the FDA, is going to be taking on the topic. So we're poised to see exponential growth. And what's really exciting is this exponential growth is going to be in a lot of different areas. Wearables is definitely going to be one of them. And we're going to see different types of sensors, giving wearables a completely new definition. We're going to see it in a lot of different software and apps that are becoming digital therapeutic. We're going to see it in a lot of different types of machine learning and artificial intelligence applications and in a myriad of other places. So we're just at the beginning of a huge growth spurt for wearables, sensors, and other types of digital health technologies. In this case, I think one of the biggest difficulties is going to be knowing where to start, how to even define digital health, which wearables to use, how to incorporate them, and knowing how to navigate the landscape without getting caught up in the new and shiny objects that might sound so appealing.
Yeah, and to look into the future, we actually started by looking into the past. So we looked at the statistics from the National Institute of Health, and when you perform a search on clinicaltrials.gov using key-term wearables and using the time period of January to December of just last year, 2016, you'll actually uncover that there were approximately 300 trials that incorporated some type of wearable device. And also, I should note that the distribution is across many therapeutic areas. So to your point about what does the future hold, definitely fair to say that the concept of wearables is relevant across all therapeutic areas. However, when you think about it, greatest benefit probably is going to be in diseases that have a gap in fully understanding the patient experience. And for example, let me talk about three different therapeutic areas. Number one, looking at chronic diseases, we can see in diabetes that Omega Health is incorporating the use of a wearable, glucose monitor, and mobile app to help patients manage their diabetes. Next, in neurology, we see a wearable that's called an ActiBelt, which actually looks like and is worn like a regular belt to hold up your pants, but it's really measuring the patient's walking ability for those who are affected with multiple sclerosis. And lastly, in dermatology, we see a disease like atopic dermatitis that it's not just about reducing the irritation or improving the appearance of the skin, but it's also important to understand the sleep disturbances that are caused by the itching. So recently, we've seen a lot of actigraphs being used to measure sleep disturbance in these atopic dermatitis patients.
Well, Nelia and Michael, I want to thank you both for a very informative, intriguing interview. Exciting, as always, to speak to you about this fast-paced, dynamic environment of wearables and clinical trials and learning how we could optimize digital health and clinical research to essentially improve the patient/consumer experience. Thank you very much for joining us for this podcast. And till next time, this is John Doyle from Real World Insights at Quintiles IMS.